This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Trespasser by Tana French, read for you by Hilda Fay. Prologue. My ma used to tell me stories about my da. The first one I remember, he was an Egyptian prince who wanted to marry her and stay in Ireland forever. Only his family made him go home to marry an Arabian princess. She told a good story, my ma. Amethyst rings on his long fingers. The two of them dancing under turning lights. His smell like spices and pine. Me, spread-eagled under my bedsheet, coated in sweat like I'd been dipped. It was winter, but the corpo set the heating for the whole block of flats, and the windows on the high floors didn't open. I crammed that story into me as deep as I could and kept it there. I was only little. That story held my chin high for years, till I was 8 and told it to my best friend Lisa, who broke her shite laughing. A couple of months later, once the sting had faded, I marched into the kitchen one afternoon, stuck my fists on my hips and demanded the truth. My ma didn't miss a beat, squirted fairy liquid and told me he was a medical student over from Saudi Arabia. She met him because she was studying nursing. Lots of nice details there, the long shifts and the tired laughs and the two of them saving some kid who'd been hit by a car. By the time she found out I was on the way, he was gone. Back to Saudi, without leaving an address. She dropped out of nursing college and had me. That one kept me going for another while. I liked it. I even started making secret plans to be the first person from my school ever to become a doctor, seeing as it was in my blood and all. That lasted till I was 12 and got detention for something. And got an earful from my ma about how she wasn't having me end up like her, with no leaving cert and no hope of anything but minimum wage cleaning jobs for the rest of her life. I'd heard it all 1,000 times before, but that day it occurred to me that you need a leaving cert to study nursing. On my 13th birthday, I sat across the cake from her and told her this time I wasn't messing. I wanted to know. She sighed, said I was old enough to know the truth, and told me he was a Brazilian guitarist she'd gone out with for a couple of months, till one night at his flat, he beat the shite out of her. When he fell asleep, she robbed his car keys and drove home like a bat out of hell. The dark roads rained empty, and her eye throbbing in time with the wipers. When he rang sobbing and apologising, she might even have taken him back. She was 20. Only by then, she knew about me. She hung up on him. That was the day I decided I was going to be a cop when I left school. Not because I wanted to go Catwoman and all the abusers out there, but because my ma can't drive. I knew the cop training college was somewhere down the country. It was the fastest way I could think of to get out of my ma's flat without taking that dead-end cleaning job. My birth cert says unknown, but there are ways. Old friends, DNA databases. And there are ways I could have kept pushing my ma, turning up the pressure every time, till I got something near enough to true that I could work from it. I never asked her again. When I was 13, it was because I hated her guts, for all the time I'd spent moulding my life around her bullshit stories. By the time I was older, by the time I made it into training college, it was because I thought maybe I knew what she had been doing, and I knew she had been right. Chapter 1. The case comes in. Or anyway, it comes in to us. On a frozen dawn in the kind of closed down January that makes you think the sun's never going to drag itself back above the horizon. Me and my partner are finishing up another night shift, the kind I used to think wouldn't exist on the murder squad. A massive scoop of boring and a bigger one of stupid, topped off with an avalanche of paperwork. Two scumbags decided to round off their Saturday night out by using another scumbag's head as a dance mat. For reasons that are clear to no one, including them, we turned up six witnesses, every one of whom was banjo drunk, every one of whom told a different story from the other five, and every one of whom wanted us to forget the murder case and investigate why he had been thrown out of the pub, sold bad skunk, ditched by his girlfriend. By the time witness number six ordered me to find out why the dole had cut him off, I was ready to tell him it was because he was too stupid to legally qualify as a human being and kick all their arses out onto the street. But my partner does patience better than I do, which is one of the main reasons I keep him around. We eventually managed to get four of the witness statements matching, not only each other but the evidence, meaning now we can charge one of the scumbags with murder and the other one with assault, which presumably means we've saved the world from evil in some way that I can't be arsed figuring out. We've signed over the scumbags for processing and we're typing up our reports, making sure they'll be on the gaffer's desk all nice and tidy when he comes in. Across from me, Steve is whistling, which out of most people would make me want to do damage. But he's doing it right. Some old trad tune that I quarter remember from sing-songs when I was a kid. Low and absent and contented, breaking off when he needs to concentrate and coming back with easy trills and flourishes when the report starts going right again. Him and the whispery hum of the computers and the winter wind idling around the windows. Just those, and silence. Murder works out of the grounds of Dublin Castle, smack in the heart of town, but our building is tucked away a few corners from the fancy stuff the tourists come to see, and our walls are thick. Even the early morning traffic out in Dame Street only makes it through to us as a soft, undemanding hum. The jumbles of paperwork and photos and scribbled notes left on people's desks look like they're charging up, thrumming with action waiting to happen. Outside the tall sash windows, the night is thinning towards a chilled grey. The room smells of coffee and hot radiators. At that hour, if I could overlook all the ways the night shift blows, I could love the squad room. Me and Steve know all the official reasons we get loaded down with night shifts. We're both single. No wives or husbands or kids waiting at home. We're the youngest on the squad. We can take the fatigue better than the guys looking at retirement. We're the newbies. Even me. 2 years in. So suck it up, bitches. Which we do. This isn't uniform, where if your boss is a big bad meanie, you can put in a request for reassignment. There's no other murder squad to transfer to. This is the one and only. If you want it, and both of us do, you take whatever it throws at you. Some people actually work in the murder squad I set my sights on, way back when. The one where you spend your day playing knife-edge mind games with psychopathic geniuses, knowing that one wrong blink could mean the difference between victory and another dead body down the line. Me and Steve, we get to rubberneck at the cunning psychopaths when the other lads walk them past the interview room where we're bashing our heads against yet another spouse of the year from our never-ending run of domestics, which the gaffer throws our way because he knows they piss me right off. The head-dancing morons at least made a change. Steve hits print, and the printer in the corner starts its rickety wheeze. "You done?" he asks. "Just about." I'm scanning my report for typos, making sure the gaffer's got no excuse to give me hassle. He links his fingers over his head and stretches backwards, setting his chair creaking. "Pint, the early houses will be opening." "You must be joking." "To celebrate." Steve, God help me, also does positivity better than I do. I give him a stare that should nip that in the bud. "Celebrate what?" He grins. Steve is 33, a year older than me, but he looks younger. Maybe the schoolboy build, all gangly legs and skinny shoulders. Maybe the orange hair that sticks up in the wrong places. Or maybe the relentless, god-awful cheerfulness. We got them. Did you not notice? Your granny could have got those too. Probably. And she'd have gone for a pint after. She was an alco, yeah? Total lush. I'm just trying to live up to her standards. He heads for the printer and starts sorting pages. Come on. Nah. Another time. I don't have it in me. I want to go home. Go for a run. Stick something in the microwave and fry my brain with shite telly. And then get some sleep before I have to do it all over again. The door bangs open and O'Kelly, our superintendent, sticks his head in, early as usual to see if he can catch anyone asleep. Mostly he arrives all rosy and shiny, smelling of shower and fry-up, every line of his comb-over in place. I can't prove it's to rub it into the tired bastard's stinking of night shift and stale spar danishes, but it would be in character. This morning, at least, he looks ragged around the edges. Eye bags, tea stain on his shirt. Which I figure is probably my bit of satisfaction for the day used up right there.
Morin, Conway, he says,
eyeing us suspiciously.
Anything good come in?
Street fight, I say. One victim. Forget the hit to your social life. The real reason everyone hates night shift is that nothing good ever comes in. The high-profile murders with complex backstories and fascinating motives might happen at night, sometimes, but they don't get discovered till morning. The only murders that get noticed at night are by drunk arseholes, whose motive is that they're drunk arseholes. We'll have the reports for you now.
Kept you busy, anyway. You sorted.
Give or take. We'll tie up the loose ends tonight.
Good, O'Kelly says. Then you're free to work this.
And he holds up a call sheet. Just for a second, like a fool, I get my hopes up. If a case comes in through the gaffer, instead of through our admin straight to the squad room, it's because it's something special. Something that's going to be so high profile, or so tough, or so delicate, it can't just go to whoever's next on the rota. It needs the right people. One straight from the gaffer hums through the squad room, makes the lads sit up and take notice. One straight from the gaffer would mean me and Steve have finally worked our way clear of the loser's corner of the playground. We're in. I have to close my fist to stop my hand reaching out for that sheet. What is it? O'Kelly snorts.
You can take that feeding time look off your face, Conway. I picked it up on my way in, said I'd bring it upstairs to save Bernadette the hassle. Uniforms on the scene say it looks like a slam dunk domestic.
He throws the call sheet on my desk.
I said you'll tell them what it looks like. Thanks very much. You never know. You could be in luck. It might be a serial killer.
To save the admin the hassle, my arse, O'Kelly brought up that call sheet so he could enjoy the look on my face. I leave it where it is. The day shift'll be in any minute.
And you're in now. If you've got a hot day to get to, then you better hurry up and get this solved.
We're working on our reports.
Jesus, Conway. They don't need to be James Bloody Joyce. Just give me what you've got. You'd want to get a move on. This York's in stony batter and they're digging up the keys again.
After a second, I hit print. Steve, the little lickarse, is already wrapping a scarf around his neck. The gaffer has wandered over to the roster whiteboard and is squinting at it. He says,
"You'll need backup on this one."
I can feel Steve willing me to keep the head. We can handle a slam dunk domestic on our own, I say. We've worked enough of them. and someone with a bit of experience might teach you how to work them right.
How long did you take to clear that Romanian young one?
5 weeks.
With two witnesses who saw her fella stab her, and the press and the equality shower yelling about racism, and if it was an Irish girl, we'd have made an arrest by now. The witnesses wouldn't talk to us.
Steve's eye says, shut up, Antoinette.
Too late. I've bitten. Just like O'Kelly knew I would.
Exactly. And if the witnesses won't talk to you today, I want an old hand around to make them.
O'Kelly taps the whiteboard.
Breslin's due in. Have him. He's good with witnesses.
I say, Breslin's a busy man. I'd say he's got better things to do with his valuable time than hand-holding the likes of us.
He has, yeah. But he's stuck with you. So you better not waste his valuable time.
Steve is nodding away, thinking at me at the top of his lungs. Shut your gob. Could be a lot worse.
Which it could be.
I bite down the next argument.
I'll ring him on the way, I say, picking up the call sheet and stuffing it in my jacket pocket.
He can meet us there.
Make sure you do. Bernadette's getting onto the text and the pathologist, and I'll have her find you a few floaters. You won't need the world and his wife for this.
O'Kelly heads for the door, scooping up the printer pages on his way. And if you don't want Breslin making a show at the pair of you, get some coffee into you. You both look like shite.
In the castle grounds, the street lamps are still on, but the city is lightening, barely, into something sort of like morning. It's not raining, which is good. Somewhere across the river there could be shoe prints waiting for us, or cigarette butts with DNA on them. But it's freezing and damp, a fine haze haloing the lamps, the kind of damp that soaks in and settles till you feel like your bones are colder than the air around you. The early cafes are opening. The air smells of frying sausages and bus fumes.
You need to stop for coffee? I ask Steve.
He's wrapping his scarf tighter.
Jesus, no.
The faster we get down there. He doesn't finish. Doesn't have to. The faster we get to the scene, the more time we have before teacher's best boy pops up to show us poor thick Egypts how it's done. I'm not even sure why I care at this point, but it's some kind of comfort to know Steve does too. We both have long legs. We both walk fast, and we concentrate on walking. We're headed for the carpool. It would be quicker to take my car or Steve's, but you don't do that. Ever. Some neighbourhoods don't like cops, and anyone who bottles my Audi TT is gonna lose a limb. And there are cases. You can never tell what one's in advance, not for definite, where driving up in your own car would mean giving a gang of lunatic thugs your home address. Next thing you know, your cat's been tied to a brick, set on fire and thrown through your window. I mostly drive. I'm a better driver than Steve, and a way worse passenger. Me driving gets us both where we're going in a much happier mood. In the carpool, I pick out the keys to a scraped-up white Opel Kadett. Stony Batter is old Dublin, working class and never worked class, mixed with handfuls of yuppies and artists who bought there during the boom because it was so wonderfully authentic, meaning because they couldn't afford anywhere fancier. Sometimes you want a car that's going to turn heads. Not this time.
Ah, shite, I say, swinging out of the garage and turning up the heat in the car.
I can't ring Breslin now. Gotta drive.
That gets Steve grinning.
Hate that. And I've got to read the call sheet. No point us arriving on the scene without a clue. I floor through a yellow light, pull the call sheet out of my pocket and toss it to him.
Go on. Let's hear the good news.
He scans. Call came into Stony Batter station at 5:06. Caller was a male, wouldn't give his name, private number. Meaning an amateur, if he thinks that'll do him any good. The network will have that number first within hours. He said there was a woman injured at number 26 Viking Gardens. The station officer asked what kind of injury. He said she'd fallen and hit her head. The station officer asked, was she breathing? He said he didn't know, but she looked bad. The uniform started telling him how to check her vitals, but he said, get an ambulance down there fast, and hung up. Can't wait to meet him, I say. Bet he was gone before anyone showed up, yeah? Oh, yeah. When the ambulance got there, the door was locked, no one answering. Uniforms arrived and broke it in. Found a woman in the sitting room, head injuries. Paramedics confirmed she was dead. No one else home, no sign of forced entry, no sign of burglary. If the guy wanted an ambulance, why'd he ring Stony Batter Station? Why not 999? Maybe he thought 999 would be able to track down his phone number, but a cop shop wouldn't have the technology. So he's a bloody idiot, I say. Great. O'Kelly was right about the keys. The department for digging up random shit is going at one lane with a jackhammer. The other one's turned into a snarl that makes me wish for a vaporizer gun. Let's have the lights. Steve scoops the blue flasher out from under his seat. Leans out the window and slaps it on the roof. I hit the siren. Not a lot happens. People helpfully edge over an inch or two, which is as far as they can go. Jesus Christ, I say. I'm in no humour for this. So how come the uniforms think it's a domestic? Does anyone else live there? Husband? Partner? Steve scans again. Doesn't say. Hopeful sideways glance at me. Maybe they got it wrong, yeah? Could be something good after all. No, it's fucking not. It's another fucking domestic. Or else it's not even murder. She died from a fucking fall, just like the caller said. Because if there was a snowball's chance in hell that it was anything halfway decent, O'Kelly would have waited till the morning shift, got in and given it to Breslin and McCann or some other pair of smarmy little... Jesus! I slam my fist down on my horn. Do I have to go out there and arrest someone? Some idiot up at the front of the traffic jam suddenly notices he's in a car and starts moving. The rest get out of my way and I floor it, round onto the bridge and across the Liffey to the north side. The sudden semi-quiet away from the quays and the workmen feels huge. The long runs of tall red brick buildings and shop signs shrink and split into clusters of houses, give the light room to widen across the sky, turning the low layer of clouds grey and pale yellow. I kill the siren. Steve reaches out the window and gets the flasher back in. He keeps it in his hands. Scrapes a smear of muck off the glass, tilts it to make sure it's clean. Doesn't go back to reading. Me and Steve have known each other 8 months, been partnered up for 4. We met working another case, back when he was on cold cases. At first I didn't like him. Everyone else did, and I don't trust people who everyone likes. Plus, he smiled too much. But that changed fast. By the time we got the solve, I liked him enough to use my 5 minutes in O'Kelly's good books, putting in a word for Steve. It was good timing. I wouldn't have been in the market for a partner off my own bat. I liked going it alone. But O'Kelly had been getting louder about how clueless newbies didn't fly solo on his squad. And I don't regret it, even if Steve is a chirpy little bollocks. He feels right. Across from me when I glance up in the squad room, shoulder to shoulder with me at crime scenes, next to me at the interview table. Our solve rate is up there. Whatever O'Kelly says. And more often than not, we go for that pint to celebrate. Steve feels like a friend, or something on the edge of it. But we're still getting the hang of each other. We still have no guarantees. I have the hang of him enough to know when he wants to say something anyway. I say, what? Don't let the gaffer get to you. I glance across. Steve is watching me, steady-eyed.
Are you telling me I'm being oversensitive? Seriously?
It's not the end of the world if he thinks we need to get better with witnesses. I whip down a side street at double the speed limit, but Steve knows my driving well enough that he doesn't tense up. I'm the one gritting my teeth.
Yeah, it bloody well is. Oversensitive would be if I cared what Breslin or whoever thinks of our witness technique, which I don't give a damn about. But if O'Kelly thinks we can't handle ourselves, then we're going to keep getting these bullshit nothing cases, and we're going to keep having some tosser looking over our shoulders. You don't have a problem with that?
Steve shrugs.
Breslin's just backup. It's still our case.
We don't need backup. We need to be left the fuck alone to do our job.
We will be. Sooner or later.
Yeah. When?
Steve doesn't answer that, obviously.
I slow down. The cadet handles like a shopping trolley. Stony Batter is getting its Sunday morning underway. Runners pounding along the footpaths, pissed off teenagers dragging dogs and brooding over the unfairness of it all. A girl in clubbing gear wandering home with goosebumps on her legs and her shoes in her hand. I say, I'm not going to take this much longer.
Burnout happens. It happens more in the squads like Vice and Drugs, where the same vile shite keeps coming at you every day and nothing you do makes any difference. You burst your bollocks making your case and the same girls keep on getting pimped out just by a new scumbag. The same junkies keep on buying the same gear just from a new drug lord. You plug one hole, the shite bursts through in a new place and just keeps on pouring. That gets to people. In murder, if you put someone away, anyone else he would have killed stays alive. You're fighting one killer at a time instead of the whole worst side of human nature. And you can beat one killer. People last in murder, last their whole careers. In any squad, people last a lot longer than 2 years. My 2 years have been special. The cases aren't a problem. I could take back-to-back cannibals and kid killers. Never miss a wink of sleep. Like I said, you can beat one killer. Beating your own squad is a whole other thing. Steve has the hang of me enough to know when I'm not just blown off steam. After a second, he asks,
what would you do instead?
Transfer back to missing persons?
Nah, fuck that. I don't go backwards.
One of my mates from school, he's a partner in a security agency. The big stuff, bodyguards for high flyers. International, not nabbing shoplifters at pennies. He says anytime I want a job. I'm not looking at Steve, but I can feel him motionless and watching me. I can't tell what's in his head. Steve's a good guy, but he's a people pleaser. With me gone, he could fit right into the squad, if he felt like it. One of the lads, working the decent cases and having a laugh. Easy as that. The money's great, I say. And in there, being a woman would actually be a plus. That's what a lot of these guys want for their wives, daughters, women, bodyguards. For themselves too. Less obvious. Steve says, are you going to ring him? I pull up at the top of Viking Gardens, the clouds broken up enough that light leaks through, a thin skin of it coating the slate roofs, the leaning lamppost. It's the most sunlight we've seen all week. I say, I don't know. I already know Viking Gardens. I live a 10-minute walk away because I like Stony Batter, not because I can't afford anything fancier. And one of the routes I use for my run goes past the top of the road. It's less exciting than it sounds. A scruffy cul-de-sac
lined with Victorian terraced cottages fronting straight onto patched-up pavements. Low slate roofs, net curtains, bright painted doors. The street is narrow enough that the parked cars all have two tyres on the curb. This is about as long as we can get away with not ringing Breslin, before he shows up at work and the gaffer wants to know what he's doing there. Before we get out of the car, I ring his voicemail, which may or may not buy us a few extra minutes, but at least it saves me making chit-chat, and leave a message. I make the case sound boring as shite, which doesn't take much, but I know that won't slow him down. Breslin likes thinking he's Mr. Indispensable. He'll show up just as fast for a shitty domestic as he would for a skin-stripping serial killer, because he knows the poor victim is bollocksed until he gets there to save the day. "Let's move," I say, swinging my satchel over my shoulder. Number 26 is the one down the far end of the road, with the crime scene tape and the marked car and the white technical bureau van. A cluster of kids hanging about by the tape scatter when they see us coming. "Ah, run! Here, missus! Get him! He robs toffee pops out of the shop! Here, shut the fuck up, you!" But we still get watched all the way down the road. Behind the net curtains, the windows are popping questions like popcorn. "I want to wave," Steve says under his breath.
"Can I wave? Yeah?
Act your age, you." But the shot of adrenaline is hitting me too, no matter how I fight it. Even when you know trained chimps could do your job that day, the walk to the scene gets you, turns you into a gladiator walking towards the arena, a few heartbeats away from a fight that'll make emperors chant your name. Then you take a look at the scene. Your arena and your emperor go up in smoke, and you feel shittier than ever. The uniform at the door is just a kid, long, wobbly-looking neck and big ears holding up a too big hat. "Detectives," he says, snapping upright and trying to work out whether to salute. "Gag the J.P. Dooley." Or something. His accent needs subtitles. "Detective Conway," I say, finding gloves and shoe covers in my bag. "And that's Detective Moran. Seen anyone hanging around who shouldn't be?"
"Just them kids, like."
The kids will need talking to, and so will their parents. The thing about old neighbourhoods, people still mind each other's business. It doesn't suit everyone, but it suits us.
"We didn't do any door-to-door yet. We thought you might want it on your own way, like."
"Good call," Steve says, pulling on his gloves.
"We'll get someone onto it. What was that like when you got here?"
He nods at the cottage door, which is a harmless shade of blue, splintered where the uniform splashed it in.
"Closed,"
the uniform says promptly.
"Well, yeah, I got that," Steve says, but with a grin that makes it a shared joke, not the smackdown I would have pulled out.
"Closed how?" "Bolted, double locked on the latch."
"All right, sorry, I..."
The uniform's gone red.
"There's a chub lock and a Yale. 'Twasn't double lock, but on the latch only."
Meaning if the killer left this way, he just pulled the door closed behind him. He didn't need a key.
"Alarm going off?" "No, like there is an alarm system, like."
The uniform points at the box on the wall above us.
"But it wasn't set. It didn't go off when we went in, even."
"Thanks," Steve says, giving him another grin.
"That's great."
The uniform goes scarlet. Stevie has a fan. The door swings open, and Sophie Miller sticks her head out. Sophie has big brown eyes and a ballerina build and makes a hooded white boiler suit look some kind of elegant. So a lot of people try to give her shit, but they only try once. She's one of the best crime scene techs we've got. Plus, the two of us like each other. Seeing her is more of a relief than it should be.
"Hey,"
she says.
"About time."
"Roadworks," I say. "How are you? What have we got?" "Looks like another lover's tiff to me. Have you called dibs on them or what?"
Better than gangsters, I say. I feel Steve's quick, startled glance throw him a cold one back. He knows me and Sophie are mates, but he should also know I'm not going to go crying on my mate's shoulder about squad business. At least on domestics, you get the odd witness who'll talk. Let's have a look.
The cottage is small. We walk straight into the sitting slash dining room. Three doors off it, and I already know which is what. Bedroom off to the left. Kitchen straight ahead. Shower room to the right of that. The layout is the same as my place. The decor is nothing like, though. Purple rug on the laminate flooring. Heavy purple curtains trying to look expensive. Purple throw artistically arranged on the white leather sofa. Forgettable canvas prints of purple flowers. The room looks like it was bought through some decorate your home app where you plug in your budget and your favourite colours and the whole thing arrives in a van the next day. In there it's still last night. The curtains are closed. The overhead lights are off. But standing lamps are on in odd corners. Sophie's techs, one kneeling by the sofa picking up fibres with sellotape, one dusting a side table for prints, one doing a slow sweep with a video camera, have their headlamps on. The room is stifling hot and stinks of cooked meat and scented candle. The tech by the sofa is fanning the front of his boiler suit, trying to get some air in there. The gas fire is on, fake coals glowing, flames flickering away manically at the overheated room. The fireplace is cut stone, fake rustic to go with the adorable little artisan cottage. The woman's head is resting on the corner of the hearth. She's on her back, knock-kneed, like someone threw her there. One arm is by her side, the other is up over her head, bent at an awkward angle. She's maybe 5'7", skinny, wearing spike heels, plenty of fake tan, a tight-fitting cobalt blue dress, and a chunky fake gold necklace. Her face is covered by blonde hair, straightened and sprayed so ferociously that even murder hasn't managed to mess it up. She looks like dead Barbie. "We got an ID?" I ask. Sophie lifts her chin at a table by the door. A few letters, a small neat stack of bills. Odds are she's Ashlyn Gwendolyn Murray. She owns the place. There's a property tax statement in there. Steve flips bills. "No other names," he says to me. "Looks like it was just her." One look at the room, though, and I can see why everyone figures this for boy beats girl. The small round table in the dining area is covered in a purple tablecloth. Two places laid out, white cloth napkins in fancy folds. The gas flames twinkling in china and polished silver. Open bottle of red, two glasses, clean, a tall candlestick. The candle is burnt down to nothing, drips of wax stalagmited on the candlestick and spotting the tablecloth. There's a wide splotch of blood on the fireplace around, spreading from under her head, dark and sticky. None anywhere else, as far as I can see. No one bothered to lift her after she went down, hold her, try and shake her awake. Just got the hell out of Dodge. "Fell and hit her head," the caller said. Either it's true, and Loverboy panicked and did a legger. It happens. Good little citizens, so petrified of getting in trouble that they act squirrely as serial killers. Or, he helped her fall. "Cooper been yet?" I ask. Cooper is the pathologist. He likes me better than he likes most people. But he still wouldn't have stuck around. If you're not at the scene when Cooper shows up to do the preliminary, that counts as your problem. Not his. "Just left," Sophie says. She has one watchful eye on her techs. "He says she's dead, just in case we miss that." Her being right next to the fire messed with the rate of cooling
and the onset of rigour. So time of death is dodgy. Anywhere between 6 and 11 yesterday evening.
Steve nods at the table. Probably before 8:30, 9. Any later they'd have started eating.
Unless one of them works an odd shift, I say.
Steve puts that in his notebook. Something for the floaters to check out once we have an ID on the dinner guest.
The call came in as injuries from a fall. Did Cooper say whether that a fit?
Sophie snorts.
Yeah, right. The special kind of fall? The back of her head smashed in, and the injury looks to match the corner of the fireplace. Cooper's basically sure that's what killed her. But he won't say so till the post-mortem. Just in case Peruvian arrow poison or whatever. But she's also got abrasions and a major hematoma on the left side of her jaw. A couple of cracked teeth, probably a cracked jawbone too. But Cooper won't swear till he gets her on the table. She didn't fall on the fireplace from two angles at once.
I say, someone hit her in the face. She went over backwards, smacked her head on the fireplace.
You're the detectives, but that's what it sounds like to me.
The woman's nails are long and cobalt blue to match her dress. And perfect. Not one broken. Not one even chipped. The pretty photography books on the coffee table are still nicely lined up. So are the pretty glass Watsits and the vase of purple flowers on the mantelpiece. There's been no struggle in here. She never got a chance to fight back.
Cooper have any clue what he hit her with? I ask.
Going by the bruise pattern, Sophie says, his fist, meaning he's right-handed.
Meaning no weapon. Meaning nothing that can be fingerprinted or linked to a suspect.
Steve says, a punch hard enough to crack her teeth? It's got to have banged up his knuckles. You won't be able to hide that.
And, if we're really in luck, he split a knuckle. Left DNA on her face.
That's if his hands were bare, I say. A night like last night, chances are he was wearing gloves.
Inside?
I nod at the table. She never got as far as pouring the wine. He hadn't been here long.
Hey, Steve says, mock cheery.
At least it's murder. Here you were worried we'd been hauled out for someone's granny who tripped over the cat.
Great, I say. I'll save the happy dance for later.
Cooper say anything else?
No defensive injuries, Sophie says. Her clothing's all in place. There's no sign of recent intercourse and no semen showed up on any of her swabs. So you can forget sexual assault.
Steve says,
unless our fella tried it on. She said no. And he gave her a punch to subdue her. Then, when he realised what was after happening, he got spooked and did a legger.
Whatever. You can forget completed sexual assault anyway. Is that better?
Sophie's only met Steve the once. She hasn't decided whether she likes him yet.
I say, attempted doesn't play either. What, he walks in the door and shoves his hand straight up her skirt? Doesn't even wait till they've had a glass of wine, and his chances are better.
Steve shrugs.
Fair enough, maybe not.
This isn't him diving into a sulk the way a lot of D's would if their partner contradicted him. Especially in front of someone who looks like Sophie.
He means it.
It's not that Steve has no ego. All D's do. Just that his isn't tied to being Mr. Big Balls all the time. It's tied to getting stuff done. Which is good. And to people liking him. Which comes in useful and which I watch like hell.
Her phone show up? I ask.
Yeah, over on that side table. Sophie points with her pen.
It's been fingerprinted. If you want to play with it, go ahead. Before we check out the rest of the cottage, I squat down by the body and carefully, one-fingered, hook her hair back from her face. Steve moves in beside me. Every murder Dee I've ever known does it. Takes one long look at the victim's face. It doesn't make sense, not to civilians. If we just wanted a mental image of the Vic to keep us reminded who we're working for, any phone selfie would do a better job. If we needed a shot of outrage to get our hearts pumping, the wounds do that better than the face. But we do it, even with the bad ones who barely have a face left to see. A week outdoors in summer, a drowning. We go face to face with them just the same. The biggest douchebags in the squad, the guys who would rate this woman's tits out of 10 while she lay there getting colder, they would still give her that respect. She's somewhere under 30. She was pretty before someone decided to turn the left side of her jaw into a bloody purple lump. No stunner, but pretty enough. And she worked hard at it. She has on a truckload of makeup, the full works, and done right. Her nose and her chin would be little girl cute, only they have that jutting look that comes with long-term, low-level starvation. Her mouth, hanging open, showing small bleached teeth and clotted blood, is good, soft and full, with a droop to the bottom lip that looks witless now, but was probably appealing yesterday. Under the three blended shades of eyeshadow, her eyes are a slit open, staring up into a corner of the ceiling. I say, I've seen her before. Steve's head comes up fast. Yeah? Where? Not sure. I've got a good memory. Steve calls it photographic. I don't. Because I'd sound like a tosser. But I know when I've seen someone before. And I've seen this woman. She looked different then. Younger, but that could have been because she had more weight on her. Not fat, exactly. But soft. And a lot less makeup. Careful foundation, a shade darker than her skin. Thin mascara. The end. Her hair was brown and wavy, done up in a clumsy twist. Navy skirt suit, a touch too tight. High heels that made her ankles wobble. Grown-up clothes for some big occasion. But the face, the gentle snub nose, and the soft droop of the bottom lip. Those were the same. She was standing in sunlight, swaying forward towards me, palms coming up, high voice with the tremble in it. But please, I really need... Me, blank-faced, leg twitching with impatience, thinking... Pathetic. She wanted something from me. Help, money, lift, advice. I wanted her gone. Steve says, work? Could have been. The blank face took willpower on my own time. I would have just told her to get lost. We'll run her through the system soon as we get back to HQ. If she came in with a domestic violence complaint, I never worked DV. Would have had to be back when I was in uniform, and I don't... I shake my head. The searchlight sweeps of the tech's headlamps turn the room sizeless and menacing, make us into crouching targets. I don't remember anything like that. I wouldn't have been itching to get rid of her. Not if she'd been getting the slaps. The slit-open eyes give her face a sly look, like a kid cheating at hide-and-seek. Steve straightens up, leaving me to take whatever time I need. He raises his eyebrows at Sophie and points to the rectangle of light coming through the kitchen door.
Can I?
Knock yourself out. We videoed in there, but we haven't fingerprinted yet, so don't go polishing anything.
Steve picks his way past the techs into the kitchen. The ceilings are low enough that he practically has to duck going through the doorway.
How's that going?
Sophie asks, nodding after him.
All right. He's the least of my problems.
I let the Vic's hair fall back over her face and stand up. I want to move. If I walked fast and far enough, I could catch up to the memory. If I start pacing around her crime scene, Sophie will kick my arse out the door. Lead D or no.
Sounds like a blast, Sophie says. Now that you've seen the place the way we found it, can we turn on the bloody lights and stop fucking about in the dark?
Go for it, I say.
One of the techs turns on the overhead light, which makes the place even more depressing. At least the headlamps gave it some kind of personality, even if it was a creepy one. I pick my way between yellow evidence markers to the bedroom. It's small and it's spotless. The dressing table, curly white and gold yolk with a foofy skirt, like something an 8-year-old would pick out for her princess room, has none of that makeup left scattered on it. Just another scented candle and two perfume bottles that are for looks, not use. No tried and ditched outfits strewn across the bed. The daisy-patterned duvet is pulled straight and symmetrical, neatly dotted with four of those scatter cushions I'll never figure out. Aisling tidied up when she finished getting ready, hid away every bit of evidence, in case God forbid Loverboy should figure out she didn't naturally look like something he'd picked out of a catalogue. He didn't get this far, but she was expecting him to. I have a look in the fitted wardrobe. Plenty of clothes, mostly skirt suits and going-out dresses, all of it mid-range, block-colour stuff with one sparkly detail, the type of stuff that gets showcased on morning talk shows alongside blood-type diets and skin resurfacing treatments. Have a look in the curly white and gold bookcase. Load of romances, load of old kids' books, load of that god-awful shite where the author enlightens you on the meaning of life through the story of a slum kid who learns to fly. Few books about crime in Ireland, missing persons, gangland crime, murder, the irony. Some urban fantasy stuff that actually looks okay. I flip through the books. The Enlightenment shite and the true crime are covered with underlining. But no he done it note falls out. I have a look in the bedside table. Daisy patterned box of tissues, laptop, chargers, 6-pack of condoms. Unopened. I look in the bin. Nothing. I look under the bed. Not even a dust ball. The Vic's home is your shot at getting a handle on this person you're never going to meet. Even for their friends, people filter and spin, and then the friends filter all over again. They don't want to speak ill of the dead, or they're feeling maudlin about their poor lost pal, or they don't want you to misunderstand that little quirk of his. But behind the door of home, those filters fall away. You go through that door and you go looking for what's not deliberate. What would have been tidied up before anyone called round. What smells weird and what's down the back of the sofa cushions. The slip-ups that the victim never wanted anyone to see. This place is giving me nothing. Aisling Murray is a picture in a glossy magazine. Everything in here is managed as carefully as if she were expecting some candy camera show to burst in and splash her private life across the internet. Paranoid? Control freak? Genuinely, superhumanly boring? But please, couldn't you just... Don't you understand how I...
she let more slip and was more vivid in that one moment than in every detail of our home. There was no way I could have known. Not like she was wearing a sign that said, Future Vic. But still, for once, I looked a live murder victim in the eye, and I blew her off. Once the techs finish up, we'll do a serious search, which might give us more, but from the looks of things, Aisling's personality, assuming she had one somewhere, doesn't actually matter. If we can ID Loverboy and make a solid case against him, we don't need to give a damn who Aisling was. It leaves me edgy, all the same, hearing that high little girl voice, where there should be nothing. Anything? Steve asks in the doorway. Bugger all. If she wasn't lying out there, I think she never actually existed. How about the kitchen? Couple of interesting things. Come, look. Thank Jesus, I say, following him. I'm expecting the kitchen to be chrome and fake granite. Celtic tiger trendy done on the cheap. Instead, it's overcarved pine, pink gingham oilcloth, framed prints of chickens wearing pink gingham aprons. Everything I find out about this woman leaves me with less of a handle on her. Out the back window is the same walled miniature patio I have, except Aisling put a curly wooden bench on hers so she could sit out there and enjoy the view of her wall. I check the back door. Locked. First thing, Steve says. He tugs the oven open, carefully hooking a gloved finger into the door crack instead of touching the handle. Two roasting tins, full of food shriveled into crispy brown wads. What looks like potatoes and something in pastry. He pulls down the half-open door of the grill. Two blackish lumps that started out as either stuffed mushrooms or cowpats. I say, so? So it's all cooked to leather. But it hasn't actually burned. Because the knobs are still turned on, but the actual cooker's been switched off at the wall. And look. Plate full of vegetables, green beans, peas, on the counter. Pan half full of water on one of the cooker rings. The knob for the ring is turned on high. Sof, I call. Anyone turn off the cooker? You guys or the uniforms? We didn't, Sophie yells back. And I said to the uniforms, anything you touched, you tell me now. I'm pretty sure I put the fear of God into them. If they'd been fucking about with the cooker, they'd have fessed up. So, I say to Steve, maybe Loverboy was late. Aisling turned off the cooker. Steve shakes his head. With the grill, maybe. But would you turn the oven off or leave it on low and stick all the food in there to keep warm? And would you let the water for the veg get cold? Or would you keep it boiling? I don't cook. I microwave. I cook. You wouldn't switch off the whole thing, especially not if the boyfriend was running late. You'd keep the water simmering so you could throw in the veg the second he arrived. I say, our guy turned it off. Looks like he didn't want the smoke alarm going off. Soph, can you print the wall switch of the cooker for me? No problem. You check for footprints in here. No, I let you two walk all over it first to make my life more interesting, Sophie calls. Footprints were the first thing we did. It rained off and on last night, so anyone who came in would have had wet shoes. But any prints dried up a long time ago. The heat in here. And they didn't leave any decent residue. We got a few bits of dried mud in here and in there, but those could have come from the uniforms clearing the scene.
and there wasn't enough for identifiable prints anyway.
Loverboy is changing, in my mind. I had him down as some snivelling little gobshite who threw a punch that went wrong and who was probably back in his flat shitting himself and waiting for us to show up so we could spill his guts and explain how it was all her fault. But that guy would have been halfway home before Aisling's body hit the floor. He would never have been able to make himself stand still and think strategy. I say,
"He's got a cool head."
"Oh yeah," Steve says. There's a leap in his voice, like when you smell good food and you're suddenly hungry.
"He's just punched out his girlfriend. He probably doesn't even know whether she's alive or dead. But he's steady enough to think about smoke alarms and what's in the cooker. If he's a first-timer, he's a natural."
The smoke alarm is above our heads. I say, "Why not go ahead and let the food set off the alarm, but...
if the place burns down, it's going to take a lot of evidence with it.
If you get lucky, the body might even be too destroyed for us to tell it was murder.
Something to do with his alibi, maybe. If the smoke alarm had gone off, someone would have been out here a lot sooner.
Maybe he figured the longer it took us to find her, the less we could narrow down the time of death. And for whatever reason, he doesn't want it narrowed down."
"Then why call it in this morning?"
"She could have stayed here another day, maybe more, before anyone came looking. By then, time of death would have been bollocksed. We'd have been lucky to pin it down within 12 hours.
Steve is rubbing rhythmically at the back of his head, rucking up the red hair in clumps.
"Maybe he panicked." I make an unconvinced noise.
Loverboy is flicking back and forth like a hologram. Pathetic wimp, cold thinker. Wimp again.
He's cool as ice at the actual scene, but a few hours later he's freaking out.
Badly enough to call us in.
People are mad.
Steve reaches up and pokes the tester button on the smoke alarm with the tip of his biro. It beeps, working.
"Or else the call wasn't him."
I try that on for size. He runs to someone else, a mate, a brother, maybe his dad. Tells him what's after happening. The mate's got a conscience. He doesn't want to leave Aisling lying here, when she might be still alive and doctors might be able to save her. Soon as he gets a moment on his own, he rings it in.
"If it's that," Steve says, "we need the mate."
"Yeah." I'm already pulling my notebook out of my jacket pocket. Suspect, KAs, ASAP. As soon as we get an ID on Loverboy, we're going to need a list of his known associates. A mate with a conscience is one of every detective's favourite things.
"Here's the other thing," Steve says. "She hadn't put the veg in to cook, hadn't poured out the wine. Like we said before, he'd only just walked in the door."
I shove my notebook back in my pocket and move around the kitchen, cupboard full of delf with pretty pink flowers on, fridge empty except for low-fat yogurt and pre-chopped carrot sticks, and a twin pack of M&S fruit tarts for dessert. Some people keep most of their personality in their kitchens, but not Aisling. Right. So, how'd they have time to get in an argument?
This isn't a married couple who've been bickering for years. He forgets the milk and it blows up into a massive row.
These two, they're still at the fancy dinner date stage. Everyone's on their best behaviour. So what are they going to fight about the second he walks in?
You think it wasn't an argument? This was his plan all along.
I flip open the bin. M&S packaging and an empty yogurt carton.
Nah. The only way that plays is if he's a stone-cold sadist. Picks out a victim and kills her just for kicks. And that guy isn't going to be done after one punch.
I'm not saying he came over here to kill her.
Not necessarily. I'm just saying.
Steve shrugs, narrowing his eyes at a china cat with a pink gingham bow that's giving us a schizoid stare from the windowsill. I'm just saying it's weird.
We should be so lucky.
Little pink notepad stuck to a cupboard. Dry cleaning, toilet roll, lettuce. The argument might have started before he arrived. Where's that phone? I bring Aisling's mobile back into the kitchen, out of the tech's way. Steve moves in to read over my shoulder, which is another thing that most people can't do without pissing me off. Steve manages not to breathe in my ear. It's a smartphone, but Aisling has the screen lock set on swipe. No code. She's got two unread texts, but I go through her contacts first. Nothing under mum or dad or any variation. But she does have someone under emergency. Lucy Reardon. And a mobile number. I write it down in my notebook for later. Lucky Lucy is going to make the formal ID. Then I go into Aisling's text messages and start piecing together the dinner guest story. Loverboy's name is Rory Fallon, and he was due over at 8 o'clock yesterday evening. He first shows up on Aisling's phone 7 weeks ago, in the second week of December. Great to meet you. Hope you had a wonderful evening. Would you be free for a drink on Friday? Aisling made him work for it. I'm busy that night, might be able to do Thursday. And then when he took a few hours to get back to her, oops, just made plans for Thursday. She had him jump through hoops coming up with days, times, places, till finally she decided he'd done enough and they went for a drink in town. He rang her the next day. She didn't answer the phone till the third call. He begged her into graciously letting him buy her dinner in a pricey restaurant. She messed him around on that, too. Cancelled on the morning of the date. Really sorry, something's come up tonight. And made him reschedule. Somewhere in this house we're going to find a copy of the rules. I've got no time for women who play games. Or for men who play along. That shite is for teenagers, not for grown adults. And when it goes wrong, it goes way wrong. The first few games, you have a blast. Get your guy panting along after you like a puppy chasing his chew toy. Then you play one game too many, and you've got a house full of murder days. In between Aisling's little games is the rest of her thrilling life. Reminder for a dentist appointment. A few texts back and forth with Lucy Reardon about Game of Thrones. A week-old voice message from what sounds like someone from work, freaking out because his email account's been hacked, and can Aisling tell him how to reset his password? No wonder she needed to make a restaurant meal into a major drama. The invite for home-cooked dinner must have gone out in person or in a phone call. The call log shows a bunch of those from Rory, some answered, some not. None from Aisling to him. But he confirmed by text. Wednesday evening. Hi, Aisling. Just checking if we're still on for 8 on Saturday. What wine will I bring? She let him wait till the next day before she got back to him. Yes, 8 on Saturday. No need to bring anything. Just yourself. Smiley face. If he showed up without a dozen red roses, I say, he'd have been in deep shite. Maybe he didn't know that, Steve says. No flowers anywhere. We've both seen murders that boiled up out of dumber reasons. That could explain how it happened so fast. He arrives. She sees he's brought nothing. Steve is shaking his head. And what? Going by the stuff on here. She's not the type who'd tell him to fuck off and come back with a bouquet. She'd play a passive-aggressive, freeze up, let him go mental trying to figure out what he'd done wrong. The problem with Steve taking contradiction so nicely is that I feel like I have to live up to him. True enough. No wonder she got herself killed. Sometimes I worry that if I work with Steve for too long, I'm going to turn into a sweetheart.
With her pal Lucy, though, Aisling dropped the hard-to-get act. Yesterday evening, 6:49. Oh my God, I'm so excited, it's ridiculous. Getting ready, singing into Corkscrew like teenager with hairbrush. Am I pathetic or what? Lucy came back to her straight away.
Depends what you're singing.
Beyonce. Big smiley face.
Could be worse. Tell me it's not Put a Ring on It.
No.
Run the World.
Oh, well then, you're golden. Just don't feed him on celery and Rivita. You don't want him fainting from hunger before you can have your wicked way with him.
Big smiley face.
Ha ha. So funny.
Making beef Wellington.
Ooh. Get you, Gordon Ramsay.
Hello, it's just for Marks and Sparks.
Ah, gotcha.
Have loads of fun.
And be careful, okay?
Stop worrying.
Tell you everything tomorrow. Kiss, kiss, kiss. That one went out at 7:13. Just time for Aisling to put on the last layer of makeup, the last layer of hairspray, stick her M&S dinner into the cooker, swap Beyonce for mood music, and light the scented candle before the doorbell rang.
Be careful, Steve says.
When we talk to Lucy, she'll explain why she was worried. How Rory got aggressive that time in the pub when he thought Aisling was looking at another guy, or how he made her keep her coat on in the restaurant because her dress showed her cleavage, or how he used to go out with a friend of a friend, and the word was he had slapped her around. But Aisling figured it was exaggerated. And he was a lovely guy, and all he needed was someone who treated him properly.
Same old story, I say.
Next time my ma asks me why I'm still single, I'm going to tell her about this case.
Or the last one. Or the one before that.
Slam dunk lovers tiff, just like the uniforms figured. Our boy Rory practically lay down on a platter and stuck an apple in his mouth for us. I've known this was coming since back in the squad room, but some thick old part of me still feels it like a kick in the teeth. Domestics are mostly slam dunks. The question isn't whether you can arrest your guy or girl, it's whether you can build a case that'll hold up in court. A lot of people love that. It pretties up your solve rate. Looks good to the brass. But not me. It means domestics get you fuck all respect from the squad. Or I could do with it, because everyone knows the solve came easy. Which is also the other reason they piss me off. They've got a whole special level of idiotic all to themselves. You take out your wife or your husband or your shag of the day, what the fuck do you think is going to happen? We're going to be standing there with our mouths open, scratching our heads at the mind-blown mystery of it all.
Duh, I don't know, must have been the mafia.
Surprise. We're going to go straight for you. The evidence is going to pile up way over your head, and you're going to wind up with a life sentence. If you want to kill someone, have enough respect for my time to make it someone, anyone, other than the most gobsmackingly obvious person in the world. One thing on that phone, though, doesn't fit on that rock-bottom level of stupid. After the happy-clappy text with Lucy, nothing in or out for almost an hour, then at 8:09 p.m, a text from Rory. Hi, Aisling. Just checking that I've got the right address. I'm outside 26 Viking Gardens, but no one's answering the door. Am I in the right place? The text flagged as unread. Steve taps the timestamp.
He wasn't running late anyway. No reason for her to turn off the cooker.
8:15 p.m. Rory rang Aisling. She didn't pick up. He rang her again at 8:25. At 8:32, he texted her. Hi, Aisling. Wondering if I've got the weeks mixed up. I thought I was due over for dinner tonight, but it seems like you're not around. Let me know the story whenever you get the chance. Unread again.
Yeah, right, I say.
He knows damn well he hasn't got the weeks mixed up. If he needed to double check, the appointment's right there in his messages.
Steve says,
he's trying to make it sound like whatever's gone wrong has to be his fault. He doesn't want to piss Aisling off.
Or else he knows we'll be reading these and he wants to get it through to us loud and clear that he's a meek